2001 Salt Lake Sun Slam Symposium, Session 325, The Financial Exhaustion of Wilford Woodruff. Participants Edward Neil Lyman and Scott Kenny.
The beginnings of the regime of President Wilford Woodruff as the head of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints occurred at the culmination of conflict with federal government, primarily over the issue of plural marriage. That legal onslaught left the church at least $300,000 in debt, and there wasn't much income coming in from tithing because many people legitimately assumed that if they paid their tithing, it would just be confiscated and be squandered by the federal government. The relationship with the government got better after Woodruff's manifesto, but the financial challenges continued. The hierarchy had always been committed to promote home industry, and the sugar beet industry in the 1890s was in particular need of being nurtured, and the church put at least $150,000 into that. The Salt Lake Temple cost $4 million, and that was dedicated in the early 1890s, and at that dedication, President Woodruff collapsed, dramatizing his increasing physical infirmities. Perhaps more serious, in the spring of 1893, church leaders experienced the worst financial crisis that they had ever had. They couldn't even meet their own payroll, just when the most serious economic depression this country had ever faced up to that time was starting, with the panic of May 93. With church loans falling due, several of the hierarchy were dispatched east into England seeking additional loans, and they were not successful in that. At that point, the church faced bankruptcy, and President Woodruff's counselor, George Q. Cannon, conceived of a plan to promote economic independence for the Intermountain West. This had many positive aspects, including creating employment for many church members who were currently out of jobs. But it meant the most extensive capital outlay in borrowed money the church had ever been involved in. Cannon was quoted as saying by Heber J. Grant that he had unbounded faith that the church could come out all right, end quote. After a year of disappointment seeking financial backing through a New York brokerage figure named Purbeck and his Utah company that was organized out here, they found that wasn't going to work, but they also encountered another financier, a guy named Joseph Bannigan, an early rubber executive from Rhode Island, who put $500,000 into backing the sugar industry and more into railroads and electric power companies in Utah, and markedly helped Cannon accomplish those aims of maintaining control of economic resources in the Intermountain West among the Westerners, with cooperative backing from Easterners who understood that it needed to stay in control of the West. But it was an unprecedented situation of deficit spending, with which few of the other members of the Latter-day Saint hierarchy fully agreed. President Woodruff apparently possessed far more confidence in George Q. Cannon, but at age 86, he was doubtless not totally, he didn't understand all of the details of these complex economic maneuvers. From mid-July 1894 through the ensuing year 1895, Wilford Woodruff attended business or political meetings at least 84 days. This was besides his demanding regular schedule of ecclesiastical and ceremonial meetings. He noted in his journal, which Scott so ably edited, being ill or weary at least 31 times. Leaving for the Pacific coast at the end of that time for his health, which did nothing to remedy what was becoming chronic illness. Particularly in November 1894, Woodruff complained about his poor personal financial situation and related that to his feeling poorly in health at the time. The diary entries indicate he was equally concerned about the financial condition of the church he was charged to lead. It's during this period that the highest church authorities concluded to invest in the Southern Nevada gold mines. Several Latter-day Saints, including Orson Smith, who was the stake president up in Logan, and Jeremiah Langford, had been surveying on a proposed Salt Lake and Los Angeles railroad line, probably in late 1893. While thus engaged, they learned of a recently discovered Chispa mine, later called the Congress, and the Johnny mine, some 7 miles away from each other, and not actively worked during this continuing depression, but appearing promising, as did also the Sterling mine that was just a few miles away. And it had been around for a quarter of a century, but was promising and not being worked. In their initial interviews with the church first presidency, consisting of Woodruff, Cannon, and fellow counselor Joseph F. Smith, Orson Smith and Jeremiah Langford expressed absolute confidence the mining properties, quote, would clear $10,000 a month. Although the predecessor church leader, Brigham Young, had supposedly discouraged involvement in mining enterprises, a more recent church president, John Taylor, had exhibited considerable interest and involvement in the Eureka, Utah silver mine, the Bullion Beck. As the result of the 1894 conference, the Sterling Mining and Milling Company was incorporated in Utah. With Orson Smith as president, and each of the first presidency represented on that board of directors by a son. There's a Woodruff, there's a Cannon, and there's a Smith on that board of directors. Over the ensuing months, the church company acquired more than half a dozen other mining claims in the Sterling and Montgomery mining district of Nye County, Nevada, some 20 miles northwest of Pahrump, and 150 miles from the closest railroad connection to Utah at Milford. The company obviously had little extra operating capital, judging from the president seeking an additional $5,000 beyond the estimated $100,000 raised at the time of incorporation. He's asking for more money before the end of the year, 1894. Yet the church leaders cheerfully complied because of the assurance that, quote, when the mill got to running, it would help the church pay its debts, end quote. The following spring, end of 1895, saw the new 10-stamp mill commence operation, producing 2 gold bars worth $3,600, immediately sent to the bank creditors. A report in late April mentioned $4,000 worth of gold produced in 8 days. The next month, Orson Smith reported they had taken 12,000 tons from the Sterling mine. That's a long-term stockpile. At a rate of 24 tons a day, with the ore assayed at $20 a ton, Woodruff anticipated this would mean a gross of $240,000 from the stockpile on hand. Soon thereafter, the church leaders received 15.5 pounds of gold from the Sterling mine. The total yield of the time is not known, but the May reports appear to be the high point of production from the mines, at least during the period of Mormon ownership. This would have been dreadful news to President Woodruff, who had recently written that he was, quote, glad we're beginning to get something from the mines to assist us, end quote. There was another small gold brick sent in the midsummer, and a large one worth $8,000 from the Johnny in November. But by that time, trouble had set in the district. During the mine acquisition process, church investors became involved in properties with other owners and rival claimants. One of these led, in late August 1895, to several armed men running the regular employees off the Chispa property and occupying it at gunpoint, claim jumping. Although the county sheriff observed the situation, he didn't feel authorized to act until he had a warrant from the county seat of Belmont, which was more than 100 miles away. He was there as a tax collector. He didn't think he could act as the sheriff. The Mormon mine operators reported to the church leader partners that their intent was to work within the vested legal system. But other partners, the Montgomery brothers, George and Bob, with whom the disputes were aimed, hired their own gunmen and retook the property in a burst of morning rifle fire that killed the leading, quote, claim jumper, Phil Foote. The other alleged offenders subsequently traveled to Belmont and resolved charges against themselves through jail time and posting bail. Soon after this episode, church leaders resolved to attempt sale of their mine holdings. But this decision was never announced publicly and did not come to fruition until after matters got considerably worse.
The immediate impatience of the church leaders with the Sterling Company centered on continued bank overdrafts and lack of consistent gold shipments. This problem apparently stemmed from the gold-bearing ore the company had little ability to retrieve through their current milling process, not having the, quote, power to melt, end quote, the refractory ore concentrate in an effective manner. Thus it became common knowledge, and probably was known to milling experts earlier, that despite the rich gold exposed to view on many levels of the company mines, a great deal of gold had, quote, gone into the tailings dump, end quote, and more would do so if the processing failures were not resolved. Even if the milling problem remained unsolved, company prospects improved as the church-backed Salt Lake and Los Angeles Railroad moved closer to reality. George Q. Cannon's son and fellow church leader, Abram H. Cannon, was president of the railroad and reported commencing construction on the railroad to be imminent, and he was equally optimistic about the Nevada mining region visited during the summer of 96. Since the district was only 40 miles from the railway line, gold concentrates could easily be shipped to the railroad by wagon and sent from there to Salt Lake City and then either San Francisco or Denver for further refining. Besides this, there were promising experiments with new milling equipment currently underway. One need, church leaders recognized, was for a more experienced milling man to be in charge of their Nevada operations. They chose a Salt Lake non-Mormon named Thomas P. Gillespie. However, before matters improved much, Abram Cannon died at age 37, and the entire railroad promotion scheme he essentially headed collapsed. And less than a month later, Gillespie was shot in the head by an unapprehended murderer. Wilford Woodruff assumed this to be a person who had written church authorities seeking money, but local observers were convinced that it was a half-breed Indian named Bob Black, known to have grudges against Gillespie for cutting off his free use of the company store, which he'd been promised he could use by the Montgomery brothers. Just at this time, trusted outside mining consultant Thomas Weir, who had earlier been engaged to study the Nevada properties for the church and recommend arrangements under which operations could be made profitable, submitted his report. Weir's prognosis was imminently favorable, but would cost an additional $35,000. He recommended that the company needed to put $12,000 into a pipeline to provide an adequate water supply for the new processing mill he favored. And he estimated that that mill would cost another $25,000, so $35,000 total. If that were done, the plant would be capable of processing 100 tons of ore per day. He expressed confidence that with these changes and the mines again in production, there would be annual profits of $700,000 over expenses. Almost any investor would be pleased with such a prospect, but probably by this time there was absolutely nothing that anyone capable of altering Wilford Woodruff's resolve to divest the church of its mining venture at whatever losses were necessary. And to understand why this was so, it's only necessary to examine his diary for the period and gain a sense of the tremendous financial pressures he must have felt at the time. The failing health of a man of his age should not have been bearing, no, the failing health of a man who at his age should not have been bearing such worrisome burdens was also a primary factor in the situation. Besides this, it was a year of tremendous positive and negative concerns as Utah was becoming a state, with controversy over Woodruff's counselor, Joseph F. Smith, making a partisan church conference speech in favor of the Republicans, and Apostle Moses Thatcher leading some opposition from among the Democrats. It was also a time of disappointment with lobbyists who had delivered statehood, but who had gone too far in promises made in doing so. As the church leaders sought to extricate themselves from that arrangement, they felt compelled to pay prominent national Republican lobbyist James S. Clarkson the first quarter of an eventual $100,000 settlement. Besides this, what eventually became Brigham Young University was in deep financial trouble at the time, and the hierarchy was compelled to nurture it into becoming a general church institution. and the final withdrawals from Purbeck's Utah Company occurred amidst notable progress with the Sugar Factory Electric Company, and until Cannon's death, Abram Cannon's death, prospects for the railroad to Los Angeles. Woodruff's health remained poor following his return from Alaska in late July 1895 with the cooler weather until the cooler weather of mid-October of that same year. The beginning of the new year 1896 saw a marked decline of his ability to sleep and an increase in his diary complaints of illness, continuing through the spring and summer. After the month-long trip to California, the California Sea Coast, it did little to improve the situation. The church leader's physical condition can be easily discerned as an influence in his lack of patience with the mining venture. During mid-January 1896, also a spell of illness, Woodruff concluded the Sterling mines were being badly managed, not satisfactorily arranged, and were doing the church investors, quote, no good, end quote. And just before embarking on the second summer vacation, which included stays at the Hotel Del Monte in Monterey and Del Coronado at San Diego, along with some much-appreciated deep-sea fishing, the third mining meeting of that week must have been fraught with negative reports, because Woodruff concluded after it, it seems as though ruin was upon us unless we raise some money, end quote. Presumably, either to make continuing claim acquisition payments or those on milling machinery not yet paid for. The same situation faced Woodruff and his counselors who accompanied him on the trip when they returned. Three more mining company meetings occurred the first week back in Utah. The same day as the first of these meetings, Woodruff also noted in his journal that an old debt of $60,000 was due to Wells Fargo Company. On the same day as the second mining meeting, he recorded his day to be, quote, full of business with their debts, end quote. And the same day as the third meeting, he and his associates further divested themselves of the Purbeck Company, the other major venture disappointment at the time besides the Sterling Mining and Milling Company. A week later, after borrowing personal funds from several faithful Mormons, Woodruff observed, we're in a terrible financial condition, end quote. The time of this statement was just after the death of Abram Cannon and the murder of Thomas Gillespie. A week later, on the last day of September 1896, Wilford Woodruff made his last journal entry of the perplexing mining company, then repeated, quote, it looks as though the presidency would be ruined unless God opens the way. Our affairs are in a desperate condition in the temporal point of view, end quote. There were certainly other causes for this, but each time the church leader had recorded such a statement in the last year, it was after a meeting on Sterling Mine matters. It's likely that counselors Cannon and Smith did not have the heart to ask the church leader to persist in supporting the mining venture he had become so disappointed in. In fact, it appears they finally suggested a reorganization of the church office staff and procedures so that none of them would be so preoccupied with non-religious affairs. This was a move that, in the case of the aged church leader, should have been done long before. He noted with relief, quote, we resolve to make a change in our labor at the office, as it is it was overwhelming us all with fatigue. The business was more than we could pass through and do justice to. We would appoint some man to take some of the care off from us, end quote. During this time, President George Q. Cannon noted President Woodruff, quote, has not been well of late, and I have felt concerned about him, end quote. Woodruff would continue involvement in the electric power company, the sugar company affairs, but he had never again mentioned the Sterling Mining and Milling Company. Other church authorities and their agents, including banker-lawyer George M. Cannon, nephew of George Q. Cannon, continued involvement with the mining property until May 1897. This included additional borrowing of funds to pay outstanding company loans. While it's not known just how much was expended, the best estimate, and this is Leonard's, is around $200,000 during the depths of the worst economic depression yet in the nation. There are only hints of the sale, partly to Utah Catholic mining man Thomas Kearns, for a paltry sum of $131,000. Other owners later took well over $1 million from the Johnny Mine alone. But it would not have enticed Mormon leaders, by then criticized for poor investments, to have ventured back into such an endeavor. Ironically, prior to the death of George Q. Cannon in 1901, he saw to it that all Sterling losses were reimbursed through a special church fund he had long had in his charge derived from the Eureka, Utah Bullion Beck and Champion Silver Mining Company. So the church was not out money after all, although they could have used that money for something else, I guess, if he hadn't seen fit to do that. It's a sad story. It's logical that the president of the church would be discouraged with all of these financial blows. It's the only way to understand why he would walk away from such a profitable endeavor just when it looked like it was starting to be promising. Thank you.
Maybe I read too fast.
Don't worry. We'll have plenty to talk about. I enjoyed reading Leo's paper. And for those of you who don't know him, it'd be difficult to respond to anything Leo does because he's pretty much the final word on when it comes to this period of time. And his research is impeccable, and of course, coupled with Leonard Arrington, how much farther can you go? For those of you who may not be that familiar with this period of time, I want to sketch out the forest just a little bit, so to provide a little more context for Leo's paper. The federal government had decided to confiscate the church's property. In response, the church tried to save as much as it could by assigning its properties out to stake presidents. But the church still lost an enormous amount of money, and the revenues weren't coming in. And there were a lot of people during the Depression who depended on the church for subsistence. So the demands increased, the revenues were down, and this is over a period of years. Then in 93, this huge depression strikes. And so you've got the church basically being the lowest of the low during that period. So it was really a desperate situation. And in that context, George Q. Cannon came up with this scheme to save the church and the West, which is pretty much controlled by, well, at least part of the West controlled by the church, by providing huge investments in projects that would provide employment for the members of the church, primarily. And that put the church, of course, farther and farther into debt. That it would have paid off depending on how long the Depression went on, but who could estimate how long it would go on and how long it would take for the church to get its money back from the federal government. After the Manifesto of 90, it didn't just automatically come back. It took quite a while. So the church, this is really a desperate situation, and I think as Leo ably points out, the hardest time of that, I think, came in 94 to 96. And I want to provide just a little bit of context for why the investment in the gold mine seemed like such a good idea. We don't have the same kind of concept of gold now that they did at that time. Basically, a nation's wealth at that time was measured by how much gold it had. And the value of the money was only as good as the gold reserves of the country. So in a depression, the value of gold will just rise. And so it was a really good investment if it had worked out. The idea of a gold mine was a gold mine idea. To give you an idea, they thought that the... let me see, let me back up a little bit. Remember they invested in the mine in... Was it November of 94?
So.
November of 94. And just a few months before that, in June... Well, let me put this. In April of 93, the federal gold reserves fell below the magic $100 million mark, causing even greater runs on the federal treasury. Okay, now keep that figure in mind. $100 million is what they thought would provide stability for the country, and that's, you go below that, that's a big problem. In June of 94, so this is just 5 months before the church invested in it, William Jennings Bryan made his famous Cross of Gold speech. Let me see if I can... No, that wasn't in 94. Just a second. Excuse me. Let me get back to that, to you on that. In November of 94, when the church invested in the gold mine, the gold reserves of the nation... The government offered a second $50 million bond issue for that year. They're hoping that the people will bail the country out. And in February of 95, shortly after the church invested in the Sterling Mine, the federal gold reserves were down to 41 million. Okay, 41% of the magic figure. So it was a good idea to go with. January of 96, the gold levels were dangerously low, and in July of 96, and this was just a few months after Utah gained statehood, William Jennings Bryan delivers his famous Cross of Gold speech. Let me read that a little bit to you. "Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this cross of thorns, this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Bryan returns to his seat amid a stunned silence. Then, as he described it later, bedlam broke loose. For over an hour, the delegates shout and stomp, rejoicing in a new leader. Bryan has won the Democratic nomination. So the gold issue was the major issue in the nation for this time, in this presidential election. Bryan said, let's get away from the gold standard because it's ruining the working class, the masses of the nation. Can't afford it. The upshot of that was the division in the Republican Party between the regulars, the business interests, who were controlled by the business interests, and a group called the Silver Republicans, who wanted to have a dual standard of both gold and silver. Silver would have been good because it was more in plentiful supply in the West. So
that includes Trumbull and Frank Cannon.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right. No. Yeah, you're right. And it's hard to give the whole context of all of this. But there were interests in the church and their allies in silver as well. Let me just add that Frank Cannon had been elected Utah's first senator, and he was one of the Republicans who bolted the National Party in support of the Silver Republican movement, which really pissed off the general authorities because they were beholden to the business interests of things. So it was really a complex situation. Okay, that's just the context of the gold standard and the national context of the Depression and the importance of gold and how it would have been a good investment. I am curious, Leo, if you would respond to your figure of taking out $1 million from the Johnny Mine in gold after the church had sold their rights for $100,000. So, you know, they obviously lost a lot of money on that. How long did it take for those people to...
I think that was about a 10-year period.
Over a 10-year period.
After 1900.
Okay. So, short-term... it may not have been that bad of an idea to get out of it.
Well, $700,000 a year estimate isn't a bad investment.
But
over
that was
expenses. That's what their experts said they would do if they put another $35,000 in.
All right.
And they wouldn't even consider it.
The question is, the experts hadn't...
This was an expert they should have got a lot earlier.
Right.
Thomas Ware knew what he was doing. They used him before in Tooele County.
In other projects.
Hill, yes.
Right, okay. I want to push Leo a little beyond this now, because what he says, not now, I'm going to give you an opportunity to ask your questions about the Sterling Mine specifically. And then if there's time left, I'd like to come back with pushing the time period a little farther into the future, specifically in January of 98. Because Leo talks about George Buchanan bailing out the Sterling Mine debts with stock that he had control of from the Bullion Beck champion mining situation, and that created a lot of havoc in the among the leadership of the church. So, any of you have questions about the Sterling Mine project per se, which is, or Wilford Woodruff's health at this time, which is the focus of Leo's paper, please ask those questions now.
Let me ask, if you have questions, to please come and speak into the microphone so that they will be recorded.
We're being recorded. Obviously, they want to hear what you've got to say. You've got a couple of years.
Oh, good. Good. Thank you.
My question may not necessarily apply just exactly how you described or worded you wanted a question, but nevertheless, my question has to do with the fact, I believe was it in 1906 or whatever, when Joseph F. Smith came back from the Smoot hearings, that the decision was made to exit and to get the church out of a lot of the enterprises that it had been in. And I may not be totally correct in my statement, but nevertheless, I believe basically that was it. How does that relate to what was going on in the 1890s and the difficulties of the church with its investments and with its business interests? And maybe what I'm really asking is what was really the basis of the decision for the church to get out of a lot of its enterprises?
Actually, although President Joseph F. Smith was not a great financier either, and neither was Lorenzo Snow, George Buchanan was. And part of what I think Scott's going to get into is the fact that Cannon's plan succeeded in two areas. Utah Power and Light was a fantastic success, and the church owned about half the stock in that. And they didn't divest of that anytime soon. And the same with Utah Idaho Sugar Company, or what became that. Now, later they would have some stock in Union Pacific Railroad, but you can't say that was a church-promoted scheme. Theirs had failed, and they just happened to be friendly with William Andrews Clark from Montana, who built that railroad, which I've written about in California History Magazine, after Utah Historical Quarterly turned it down. it's too long and too California-y. Some of the schemes failed. They tried to promote iron mines in Cedar City and in Colville. Coal mines in Cedar City and Colville and iron mines in Cedar City. They tried a lot of other things, salt air. But the two that succeeded helped them build the financial foundation for being in the Fortune 500 now, $1 billion church corporate enterprise. I don't know what Joseph F. Smith said. Here's a biographer of Joseph F. Smith who can tell us in a minute how much he sees Smith divesting church interests after those hearings. And by the way, the Bullion Beck and the Sterling Mine came up in those Smoot hearings. I see George Buchanan bailing the church out of debt. Not any windows of heaven crusade for more tithing. But the irony is that three of the brethren in the Council of the Twelve who are against Cannon's schemes are going to be prophets for the next 50 years. How is George Buchanan ever going to get any credit? From Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, or Heber J. Grant? And so by the time they're gone, the whole issue's totally forgotten. But the church is rich. I have written a paper that will be published in Journal of Mormon History sometime. Actually, I gave that paper here last summer on George Q. Cannon's financial contributions that he's never been given credit for. I really don't think the church divested much. And I don't think you can fit their reason for dumping the gold mine into that. It's a totally different reason related to Wilfred Woodruff's determination to not touch it anymore. George Q. Cannon would have wanted to keep it, but he didn't have the heart to push this sick old man who had no business being involved in so much when he's 88 years old. It's almost a cruel thing that we do to prophets.
Why don't you talk about Joseph F. for a minute before you get into that?
I don't have that much. Yeah. Are there any other questions?
I'm just not prepared to talk about the divestiture after the Smoot hearings. It's just too complex, and I need to get back to my notes and so forth. I'm sorry I can't respond more effectively than that. I mean, at this point in the biography, I'm only up to the 60s at the very, 1860s at the very farthest.
Still a kid.
Still a kid, yeah. This relates to George Q. Cannon's standing among the brethren as a result of his investment schemes. In January of 1898, Brigham Young Jr. wrote in his diary, "President Snow asked to present the views of the Council of the Twelve to the Presidency. They came at 11:30. President Snow spoke very gently and to the point. Brother Franklin D. Richards followed in the same strain. I followed, they're going by seniority, and charged Brother Cannon of taking on himself too much of presidential authority and keeping a man who did not live as a Latter-day Saint, but drank and played billiards as the chief head of the church, right, or official organ." That's his son, Frank Cannon. And that's true. They had made Frank the church's financial agent in the East. And his Brigham Young is being generous by only describing or alluding to Frank's drinking and billiards problem. He had problems.
He mentioned his hoarding, too.
But not in this passage. And that if the presidency had submitted the question of appointing Frank J. Cannon as the church agent to borrow money in the East, he would not have been sustained. And that many people believe that President Cannon is the responsible person for all of our present financial difficulties. President Cannon resented what I said, tried to pin me down to date, and many things were said that were better unsaid, but I was the scapegoat, and President Woodruff notified to be at the office at 10:30 tomorrow morning. Afterwards, I talked with the 12, and every man stood by me, and it was the voice of the quorum that I stand firm in what I had already said. The next day, I'll skip John Henry's diary entry, except to say that John Henry Smith noted in his diary the next day that President George Q. Cannon felt very much hurt over the remarks of Elders Brigham Young and Heber J. Grant. I'd love to know what Heber J. Grant said at that time, other than probably attacking Frank Cannon. Do you have the specifics? Great. It'll be a treat. Okay, the day after that, now this is January 7th, 1898, the presidency meet in the temple at noon. Considerable talk was had, and President Cannon read a document purporting, that's my emphasis, a document purporting to have been written under President John Taylor's dictation, which gave Cannon complete control over all the Bullion-Beck dedicated stock. And help us define what dedicated stock means. When you can get to the mic. So this purported document written under Taylor's direction, which would only have been written by George Q. Cannon himself, giving Cannon complete control over this Bullion-Beck stock, which he afterwards gave up to claimants, which I presume would be the Sterling Mine folks, but there may have been others, I don't know. Maybe you can help us clarify that. And now claims that he is responsible to God alone for the management of this dedicated Bullion-Beck stock. This was all news to the council, for Brother Cannon had carried the idea that his stock was still dedicated as we understood it. I was shocked to hear Brother Cannon make this statement. I am the sole custodian of the dedicated stock. I understood President Taylor that this stock would be held independently by his successor, which would have been Wilford Woodruff, in office, to which it would have been duly transferred at proper time. So this is a major surprise to the 12 that Cannon has used this stock. All was forgiven by us, and we partook of the sacrament, I think, worthily before God. Let me have Leo go from there.
Dang. Talk about me putting you on the spot.
This is going back 20 years. I don't know if any of you remember the article in Dialogue about Moses Thatcher and him alienating himself from the other brethren. But one of the biggest issues was the Bullionbeck mine. Thatcher was in a faction of stockholders that included Cardston, Canada, and Preston, Logan guys. Apparently, John Beck, who wasn't as smart as he could have been, was close enough to John Taylor that he donated a third of his mining stock to be consecrated for whatever purposes the prophet, John Taylor, wanted to use them for. And they talked about buying Jackson County, Missouri, and they talked about a church university. But even in John Taylor's lifetime, those Logan brethren fought against the idea of not just Beck's shares of stock being consecrated, but some of theirs also. That was apparently the plan. And after John Taylor's death, it gets even worse. Scott was alluding to some Quorum of the Twelve meetings in 1898 after Wilford Woodruff died. The same thing happened in 1887 when John Taylor died. And in both cases, George Q. Cannon is the bad guy, the counselor to those two old prophets. He's actually the nephew of John Taylor. And in both cases, Heber J. Grant is one of the main critics of speaking for the prophet in ways that the rest of the quorum didn't know about. In fact, in that first meeting, George Q. Cannon admitted he'd been running the church for 4 months because John Taylor was in hiding and very ill and very out of touch with reality in some ways. And that made some of the brethren, especially Thatcher and Grant, just furious. And they really attacked George Q. Cannon. And George Q. Cannon, I was once accused of adopting him as my hero by Richard Paul, my old BYU professor, in a book review of political deliverance in the Journal of Mormon, the Journal of American History. He put it there. And there's a little controversy over that. In fact, another one of my professors, Thomas Alexander, said that Wilford Woodruff was the third most important church leader before 1900. And he knows that I would disagree with that. He's got a footnote on my disagreements in his Woodruff book. And I got the last word in the Journal of Mormon History next year. Anyway, this is really not bitter hostility toward George Q. Cannon for speaking. In the second case, these brethren he quoted actually say, he's putting words in Wilford Woodruff's mouth in his last months. That these old men can't really run the church. He's running it. He's using them. And the ill feeling is rather rampant. Now, on the Bullionbeck again, Uncle John Taylor gave George Q. Cannon the right to conduct and use that consecrated stock any way he saw without answering to anybody else. And I've got the documentation of that, and you can go back to that old dialogue article, which is, I understand, being republished with a bunch of other Mormon dissenters, including D. Michael Quinn, a chapter on him, by who's doing it? I guess Signature's doing it next year, yeah. It's not hard to find that old article, but it's got a great deal of detail on the bitterness and the controversy over that dedicated stock, which George Q. Cannon used just before he died to recoup the losses that maybe some brethren were blaming on him for pushing President Woodruff into this Sterling mine venture. That's the best I can do with that one.
Thanks, Leo. I think just to highlight the animosity between George Q. Cannon and the 12 is Brigham Young's use of the word purported document. I mean, it got to the point where he apparently believed that George Q. Cannon was not beyond fudging the truth in his own interests.
The problem of Cannon is that he doesn't like anybody questioning him. And that doesn't work very well in the church, even if you're in the First Presidency. A bigger flaw, and Scott mentioned it, is defending that worthless son. How in the world can you defend and condone what Frank's doing? Best documented by his half-brother, Abram, who bails him out of brothels and drunken stupors all of the time. It's a sad, sad story, but the alienation that has continued for over 100 years of the church leadership towards George Q. Cannon can best be focused on his son, whom he defends. And in that diary of Heber J. Grant that he wants to see so much, Frank Cannon criticizes Grant and John Henry Smith. And Heber J. Grant is just waiting for George Q. Cannon to apologize for his son, and he never does it. And that causes tremendous bitterness in President Grant toward George Q. Cannon for not having apologized for the words of his son.
Final word from me, anyway. Leo's right about Frank's character, but I think I find him one of the most fascinating characters in Mormon history. And,
I know you've got a big pile of notes on here.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite people. And I hope to get my stuff out on my website about him, or at least start to get some of it out. But I think you have to account, how does one account for Frank's, how the worm turns? Why does Frank turn from an advocate for the church in Washington to a bitter enemy? And I think a lot of that goes back to, I think he was a real, he virtually worshipped his father, I think. I think he isn't faking that when he writes his book. And so I think a lot of his animosity towards the church then comes from the way the church turned on George Q. Cannon at the end of his life.
I totally agree with that.
Okay, your time. Questions, comments?
Well, so Frank Cannon had a rotten character.
Frank Cannon may have had a rotten character, but did he do good things for the church? He was one of the most effective spokesmen for the church in Washington, D.C. In fact, in this meeting that he first alluded to, one of the more fair-minded apostles, Franklin D. Richards, said, "We know about his flaws, but he's a U.S. senator. He can probably represent us better than anybody in Washington, D.C. at this time, and among the financial centers of New York City." He's the one that found Bannegan. Bannegan is literally the financial savior of the church, and I say that in that Journal of Mormon History article. That'll be a wild statement. People will wonder, what the heck's he talking about? But Woodruff actually called Purbeck that in the diary. And Purbeck flopped. But the next year, Bannegan started a four-year loaning process, maybe loaning as much as $3 million. But we've paid that all back within a year or two after George Q. Cannon's death. And we've got all of that stock including stock that we got back from the Bannigans, that's the basis of the church fortune. I had the good fortune way back 30 years ago to discover, maybe through the negligence of the First Presidency, a huge file of financial papers that had come out of their vault to the church historian's office. And at that time, I was taking a lot of notes by reading into tape recorders. What a boring thing to do, and boring especially for the poor little high school girls that had to transcribe that because they needed some credit and were willing to be slaves. And they didn't do very good at the spelling or punctuation. But 30 years later, I have 67 legal-sized sheets, single-spaced, of First Presidency's papers that have been restricted for 25 years at least. And that was my main source for this paper I gave here last year that will be published in Journal of Mormon History. How do you cite that? I went to the church historian's office and said, what should I do with this file? I won't say who I was talking to, but they said, don't put it any place in Salt Lake City. We know you're going to put it someplace. We finally agreed on Cedar City, Southern Utah State University. Somebody's going to have to drive 300 miles to check my footnotes. But at least they will be able to do that. And it's got a lot of detail about these, especially Frank Cannon and his partner, who is just about as morally flawed, Nephi Clayton, who was one of the promoters of Salt Air and some other things. It's a fascinating subject. And Scott's right. It's really neat that everybody's left this whole decade to me. I've got a monopoly. No. I have no idea. That'll be up to Janet Figmiller. She doesn't even know what a blessing she's getting. She may not want it. I think it's yours.
Are there any other questions? Please, yes, please come up.
Well, there are three kinds of institutions: political, business, and religious. I think the thing that I look at is that the Mormon Church just isn't a church. It's a very, very powerful business too, and a very, very powerful political party. And you can't understand the church if you just understand the religious part. And I think that it seems like there's a war going on between the world and the other world, you know, in the church. And I, of course, my opinion is that the world is winning, you know, but do you think that the fact that the Mormon Church is so heavily involved in the world, and I think it's even more so now, even though we probably don't have the information, it's not as readily available. What do you think about that? I mean, is the Mormon Church still a church, or is it just a very powerful business?
Probably George Q. Cannon's greatest accomplishment was accommodation of a church group that was so attacked and so negatively seen that the Mormon question was one of the biggest issues in American politics at the time. By the time he died, the church was well thought of. His greatest accomplishments are in the area of politics, and he's the son of a gun that turned the church Republican. He had been a Democrat, and the Republicans had been anti-Mormon for 40 years, since their birth. He makes an equally important contribution, although so far mostly unknown, in economic affairs. The church is still very much a religion, but the brethren cannot honestly deny that they have a very strong interest in both business and politics. They do deny it, but their interest continues. And I don't think they do it as openly as they used to. And they have others who... Some of you heard Quinn's paper the first day here. Read some of his stuff. It shows how much the church is involved in politics. And there have been other pieces, including Arizona Republic, doing a whole series on church finances. It's unbelievable how many corporations the church is involved in and how many financial interests. And as Quinn and others would say, the church isn't anti-business in any way. In fact, some of the political leanings are because they want plenty of protection for church holdings. Now, I know that's just an opinion. I don't have a definitive thing on this, but I it's still certainly a church, but it's a church involved in politics and business in every way.
I think we have to end there with that. Thank you very much to the presenter for the interesting paper and for the comments.